the boom, men like Tobias Mortlock hit Bodie from all directions, like moths beating themselves against a street lamp. They came without jobs, without shelter, and in winter, without even the promise of firewood in this land too close to the sky for trees to take root. Some ended their days never descending a mine shaft, never laying hands on the precious gold and silver-bearing rock that called them here. There were those that froze to death, their bodies so pickled from whiskey that a snowbank seemed a warm and inviting quilt where they drifted off, still dreaming of a big strike. Others shot each other over nothing in the saloons that once dominated Main, King, and Bonanza Streets. Those that survived made money in the few years around 1880. Back then, 40 or so mining companies shipped upwards of $3 million worth of gold and silver bullion out of Bodie each year. In those days, if you were in California, but foolish enough to be anywhere but the Eastern Sierra, and careless enough not to find your way to Bodie, you were missing the point. Those were wild days, when God, the law, and anything pure and decent in the world kept its head low for fear of taking a bullet in the skull. Like Tobias Mortlock, I did not arrive in Bodie during the boom, yet unlike him, the oversight was no fault of my own. Through a sheer accident of birth, I did not enter the world until a few years later. By that time, Bodie was sliding down the chute with the low-grade ore, and 500 or so souls who neglected to leave for the next bonanza lost themselves among the boarded-up stores, houses, and saloons. Tobias Mortlock arrived in 1900, the year I turned 14, and long after the boom. This spoke of a certain lethargy and lack of ambition on his part. He came with the attitude of one who shows up absurdly late for a dinner party, mildly surprised that most of the guests have gone home. Not that newcomers were unwelcome in Bodie at that time, but what we needed were mining experts, men who could locate a ledge of rich ore or knew how to use cyanide to squeeze out the last bit of gold from discarded mill tailings. What we did not need were people stirring up trouble. It must have been early June that day I first saw Mortlock, for I remember picking my way down Green Street around the rivulets that streamed from melted snow on Silver Hill. The snow that in January had turned second floors into firsts when the wind packed it like plaster against the clapboard buildings now lay reduced to wide glittering ribbons strewn across the sage-covered bluffs. And it was definitely Sunday, for the standard stamp mill where my father worked as head machinist and where he had slowly lost most of his hearing to the pounding of the heavy iron stamps as they crushed rock into dust, was silent. There was a time, I am told, when the standard mill ran 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But in the spring of 1900, there was no need for that. Besides, it was my father's day off, and I was going to fetch him home from the Sawdust Corner Saloon, where he liked to play pool on Sundays. The Sawdust stood at the corner of Green and Main Streets, keeping watch over a dusty thoroughfare that would never be paved. It was a narrow building, with rustic boards nailed around the three windows along the side facing Green Street, its other side abutting the Standard Hotel. In front, a flat roof held up by three simple square posts shaded a small porch. What kept the saloon from being nothing more than a shack was the white facade with its arched cornice and center fanlight window that perched above the roof of the porch. I remember that this piece of architecture had previously adorned the Ellis New Depot building. Many of the better buildings in Bodie had been either carted off whole to other towns or used piecemeal in this way to spruce up ugly buildings. As I crossed Main Street, I could see Mortlock standing alone in the deep shade of the porch. He loomed up like a ghost, tall and imposing, with broad shoulders and long arms. As he walked back and forth across the porch with the languid motion of poured molasses, a well-tailored Chesterfield coat with a velvet collar swung gently on his large frame. Nearing the saloon, I was surprised to discover that this once fine coat was now dusty and frayed at the collars and hem. As I stepped onto the porch, he turned toward me, pushing his Stetson of soft felt back off his face to reveal eyes as dark as a mine shaft and a smile on long, sensuous lips. "Aren't you a trifle young for this place?" he asked in a deep voice, mellow like a tuba, the tongue lazy on the consonants. "My pa's in there playing pool. I'm going to fetch him." I could feel blood warm my face. I was in my rights to go into the sawdust, and I felt angry with this stranger for suggesting otherwise.
"Then, by all means, allow me."
He made a gallant show of opening the door for me, giving a slight bow as I passed him, but I was old enough to see that he was making fun of me. Stepping into the sudden darkness of the saloon after walking in bright sunlight blinded me to a standstill. I stood by the doorway for several seconds and breathed in the fumes of bad whiskey and fresh beer brewed with water from Bodie's deep, cold springs. Soon, the heads of men around game tables, playing cards and drinking, became visible below a wispy sheet of smoke that floated through the saloon like an angel.
"Is this 100? I heard my father ask in his loud voice from the corner of the saloon. There, an elaborately carved pool table held the attention of a group of 6 men. I crept up behind them and stood quietly, waiting for the game to end.
"Go ahead and take your shot, Mike. The game's yours," said George Everett, a worker at the stamp mill and a good friend to my father.
"I'll be damned," said my father's disgruntled opponent.
"You should know better than to challenge the best straight pool player in the Eastern Sierra," said Mr. Everett. I felt my chest swell with pride at those words.
As my father lifted his cue and leaned over the green felt surface, the saloon fell quiet as word went around that the long match was nearly won.
7 ball in the side pocket," my father said.
I heard a click of billiard balls, then the soft thud of victory.
A whooping and shouting rose up from the men as the loser grudgingly counted out crumpled bills into my father's hand.
"Your girl's here," said Mr. Everett, nudging my father and pointing in my direction.
"Ruth, is your mother all right?" my father asked with his worried look. It was his usual greeting when I appeared in the saloon on a Sunday.
"She's feeling poorly," I said.
He knew what I meant and asked no questions. He laid his cue on the table, put his arm around me, and walked me to the door.
"Fire in the head," someone shouted from the bar behind us. "Mike Conaboy, where are you going? Fire in the head, I say."
We turned around to see Ernest Owens, the apothecary, waving a glass of beer in our direction. He was treating the house to a drink and seemed hurt that my father had chosen this particular moment to leave.
"Thanks, Ernest, but we have some trouble at home," my father said, and we turned back to the door.
I could see Tobias Mortlock still standing on the porch, looking through the glass into the saloon. I had an idea that he was waiting for us to come out.
"Trouble at home?" shouted the apothecary. "I can tell you about trouble at home. Why do you think I spend my Sundays here?"
The double doors slammed behind us, cutting short the roar of laughter and capping the smell of whiskey and tobacco. We walked out into the bright sunlight and the smell of dust and hot sagebrush. Tobias Mortlock tipped his hat and introduced himself to my father.
"I am given to understand that you are the head machinist at the Standard Stamp Mill. May I trouble you for a moment of your time?"
"I'm sorry, but I'm needed at home just now. My daughter here has come to fetch me."
"And a lovely thing she is," Mortlock said, making the blood pump into my face again. May I walk along with you, then?
There's no harm in that, my father said, and the three of us headed up Green Street toward our house.
I shall get right to the point, Mr. Conaboy. I am looking for work. I have lately arrived from England by way of New York, and most recently San Francisco, and I have it in mind to make a career for myself in mining.
Are you a cousin Jack? My father asked.
If you mean, am I Cornish? No, I hail from Bournemouth, actually.
Is that a mining district?
No, I'm afraid not. It is more of a seaport.
My father gave Mortlock a questioning glance. This is a bad time to go into mining, especially here in Bodie. The only reason we're getting by now is the new cyanide extraction process.
You wouldn't be experienced in chemistry, would you?
No, not a bit. We walked on in silence the rest of the way, then stopped in front of our small parlor house. With a mixture of pride and sadness, my father gazed down at the rambling, corrugated tin structure that housed the stamp mill.
Bodie's all played out, you understand. I stay because I'm used to the place, and I figure the mine will hobble along for a few more years, and then I'll retire. Why don't you try the Empire Mine in Grass Valley? They're still going strong down there.
My father was looking at the stamp mill and didn't see the cold look that had come over Mortlock's eyes. The corners of his mouth tightened like a bowstring, but his voice remained soft and melodious.
That may be, he said, but I'm here now and asking you. Do you have anything for me or not? Just let me know, and I'll be on my way.
My father turned back to Mortlock and said, I see. This was what he usually said when he had no clue as to what the other person had just said. A thick, embarrassing silence ensued, and I felt compelled to say something.
Mr. Mortlock, my father hates to turn anyone away, but you see how it is. Come on, Pa. Mother's waiting for us.
So the answer is definitely no?
Mortlock asked, fixing his black eyes on my father.
Come and see me tomorrow at the mill, and we'll see what we can do, my father said.
We turned and went into the house, leaving Mortlock standing alone in the muddy street.
Bridget, what was your inspiration for writing A Fence Around Her?
Years ago, I lived in Northern California, in Grass Valley, which is in the heart of the gold country. And I actually have written a previous book about the gold rush. But at that time, you know, I was kind of, you know, looking for other ideas as far as, you know, what happened after the gold rush. Because we all know about the gold rush, but they continued mining in California for years and years. And I was watching TV one day, and on a local travel show, there was a show about Bodie, California, which is now a ghost town in the Eastern Sierra. Yes. And it is a state park, and it's in what they call a state of arrested decay, in the sense that they haven't like spruced it up, you know, to make it look like Disneyland or anything like this. It actually looks like it did years ago, in around 1940s, when people just kind of up and left. And for example, you go into some of these houses and there's like plates and coffee cups on the table as if people just got up and walked out, and buildings kind of falling down. And there's an old cemetery with, of course, a boot hill, you know, where people were buried outside the fence. You know, all the good people were buried inside the fence.
The good Lutherans, maybe?
Exactly. And I was watching this show, and I just said to myself, I have to go there. So I packed up my dog and took a camping trip up to a place called Twin Lakes up near Bridgeport, California. and went up to Bodie and took the tour, and I returned again the next year. After that, I moved to Nebraska, so I haven't been back since. But when I went on the second trip, I stocked up on as many books as I could carry out of the gift store there, which I've read over the years. And I just still have a fascination with Bodie.
Well, it shows in the writing, the detail. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was listening to it, it felt like I was walking down the street and I could visualize everything. So, yeah, it's nice to have someone who does their homework here. Let me ask you, as a writer, this is prose and fiction. Is it the only style of writing that you do?
No, I also write plays.
You do?
I do, yeah.
Okay.
Which is a very different type of writing. And actually, sometimes I feel like I'm using a different part of my brain when I write plays. I can't explain that. I don't journal. I did try journaling years ago and think it's, you know, fantastic for people to journal, but I think I don't really care much for writing about myself and my own life. But when I write fiction, I think it's more that feeling of journaling. I tend to be more kind of inside my own head, despite the fact that it is not, you know, about my life. Somehow my life comes out in the fiction. And when I write plays, somehow it's more like I'm watching a play in my head and writing down kind of what I hear the characters saying and doing.
What is the balance of conversation to description or movement in a play as opposed to writing prose like A Fence Around Her?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, obviously, a play is constructed of dialogue.
Okay.
There are certainly other kinds of plays and you know, things called theater pieces where, you know, you literally could have no dialogue in it. But I tend to write the more traditional plays. You know, it's really all dialogue. And what kind of stands in for, I guess, what you would call exposition would be stage directions. So, you know, if you need an actor to walk across the stage or pick up a coffee cup or make a telephone call, you know, you write that down. But of course, the audience never hears that part. The actors will just do it. So really, the story is told through dialogue. In fiction, you know, I kind of have had to be careful about this because fiction is different. And I went to a writing workshop at UNL a couple years ago, and Emily Danforth, who is a young adult fiction writer, was giving the workshop. And she liked what I wrote, but what she kind of said was, kind of forgot about, you know, what the characters are doing and thinking. I didn't realize that I literally wrote a piece of fiction that was all dialogue. And I'd gone sort of too far in that direction. I had to explain to her, well, I write plays also. So it is a little hard to keep those two things separate. So
well, you seem to be doing a good job. I mean, I really enjoyed listening to that.
Thank you.
Let me ask you kind of a question for the listeners. Writing is so much a part of our ego. Mm. It's such a personal thing. It's hard to separate it. Where could a younger person go to get help with their writing and constructive criticism that wasn't crushing? We've all seen the movies about writers and the mentor, you know, grinding them into powder and remaking them into a good writer, that kind of thing. But in reality, nobody wants to go through that.
Right.
Is there somewhere in Lincoln writing groups that you'd recommend for young people?
Yeah. You know, a good resource might be to look into the Nebraska Writers Guild.
Okay.
They have a website. Look up Nebraska Writers Guild. It's a really good organization. What's really nice is they run a listserv. So, you know, once you join, you can have like a Yahoo account, and then you can go on the listserv. And, you know, that would be a great way for people to find other writers in their area, wherever they are. And the people in Nebraska Writers Guild come from all over Nebraska. And you're talking about young people.
Even old people.
I would say, you know, I went to the conference a couple weeks ago, and I, you know, yeah, it leans toward maybe older people, but there was a young girl. I wish I knew her name. She's a wonderful writer. Maybe she'll be on the show sometime. A young 16-year-old girl who was there at that conference, and she got up and read
at the beginning of the conference, and her writing was just so lovely. And I, you know, I'm so there was this, you know, girl who is on her way to being a real writer, and she's going out there and joining Nebraska Writers Guild. For playwriting, I have to give a shout out to Angels Playwriting Collective, which I am one of the co-founders along with Judy Hart. If you are interested in writing plays, we are here in Lincoln, but we have members from outside of Lincoln. We have someone from Hastings, Robin Buckaloo, a playwright. We have playwrights who come from, you know, other towns. And it's just a wonderful group. We get together. We give very straightforward but very respectful feedback to each other. And we have public readings. And if you're interested in that, just go to the Angels Theater Company website. And, or you can email me directly, BridgetAmis@gmail.com.
Very good. Bridget, thank you for joining us today. And we look forward to the next chapter.
Yes.
And the publication.
Someday.
Of Fence Around Her. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Phil. It was wonderful being here.